Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Anthology of Horror. I'm Springheel Jack, your host. I want to thank you all for tuning back in. It means a lot to me that you guys are staying consistent and continuing to come back for more. I also appreciate that you guys have stuck with me through this awkward finding my footing startup part of this podcast. I know that the beginning has been kind of rough, and you guys have been nothing but supportive and a fantastic audience, so thank you very much. I genuinely appreciate each and every one of you. To all new listeners, welcome. Thank you for tuning in. What you're about to experience is going to be an hour or so of ad-free entertainment because I value your time, which is not the case for a lot of other podcast networks out there. I am not going to dick you around with advertisements, and you're not going to ever have to hear this.
Hey, Josefi Krakowski here with Flex Team. To show you the power of Flex Team. We saw this bolt in half and repaired it with only Flex Team. It's ready on the water. The inside is mighty dry.
Thank you, comrade. I was listening to a podcast today. I was coming back from Death Valley, and there were 10 minutes of fucking bullshit previews for what, I don't know, before they even started fucking rambling about their stupid-ass fucking whatever the fuck they were talking about. It pissed me off so bad, I just unfollowed them, which is kind of what I'm doing right now, but with that being said, and without any further ado, I've been working on this episode for quite some time, and I've been hesitant to do it because of the just depth of the subject matter. It's a motherfucker. There's a lot of information. There's a lot of misconceptions. No, I'm not, unfortunately, not yet covering the Manson family murders, but I am, in fact, covering the Jonestown Massacre and the saga and rise to power of Jim Jones. Now, my primary source for this episode is going to be The Road to Jonestown by Jeff Gwynn, which is a phenomenal book, and I strongly suggest that you check it out if you haven't already. Most of Jeff Gwynn's stuff is fucking fantastic, and I thoroughly recommend this one all the same way that I would all of his other books. So the way that Lynetta Putman Jones chose to remember it, she began life in privileged circumstances. She was only married once to a handicapped veteran of World War I. Due to his PTSD, she was terribly mistreated by him and his cruel family. She gave birth to a baby boy after a near-death mystic vision. She faced down Depression-era bankers and backwoods religious charlatans, reformed a state prison system, unionized, mistreated plant workers, and raised the world's greatest man, who was, in fact, more God than human, thanks to, almost entirely, to the constant nurturing of his devoted mother. But none of it was true, beginning with her name. Her name was Lynette Putnam. And that's not Lynette, as, not the sexy country singer name, it's Lunette. L-U-N-E-T. Lynette Putnam. She was born to Jesse and Mary Putnam on April 16th in either 1902 or 1904. Her birth records mysteriously cannot be found, and later in life she mentioned both years, occasionally throwing in 1908 as well. Even her birthplace is unknown. It's most often assumed to be Princeton in the southwest corner of Indiana, but some researchers believe that she was born in Mount Carmel. It is irrelevant where and how or what name she had when she entered the world, because after, she periodically tinkered with her name, becoming first Lunetti, then Lynette, in various census reports and legal documents, before finally settling on Lynetta. Reminiscing later in life, Lynetta described her childhood self as pretty as the first dawn and strong as a tiger. Because of her dark coloring, people often mistook her for a Native American when she was an adult. Lynetta would frequently claim that she did have Indian blood, though there's no record that she did. Her parents wanted her to act like a China doll when she was a kid, but she constantly confounded them by trampling in the woods and investigating the animals and getting dirty and making a scene. So, if true, this was an early example of Lynetta's lifelong trait of being a magnanimous rash on the ass, defying whatever was expected of her. In a convoluted partial memoir dictated in Jonestown, Lynetta described Lewis Parker, who was apparently her father's foster father, as a powerful Indiana timber mill owner who helped raise her. Parker, she said, was practically in control of what happened in southern Indiana. And according to Lynetta, Grandpa Parker was renowned for kindness to his many employees, paying them fair wages and constantly upgrading the work conditions. In particular, he always had jobs for transients, but he suffered business setbacks due both to the decline of the timber industry and his insistence on putting the welfare of others before his own. Although Lynetta's penchant for wild exaggeration makes most of her childhood and Lewis Parker tales questionable at best, it is certain that in her teen years, the girl found herself in tough financial straits. Clearly bright and fanatically ambitious, Lynetta was sustained in these hard times by her firm belief in spirits and in reincarnation. She swore she'd been a great woman in previous lives and would somehow be one again in this one. But spiritualism couldn't pay the living expenses. But attractive young women can. And in such circumstances, they have an obvious option. So in 1920, Lynetta took a traditional approach to female survival by marrying a guy named Cecil Dickinson. I think she was 16 or potentially 18 or 22. Probably 16, though. The marriage lasted about 2 years. In which time Lynetta enrolled in Jonesboro Agricultural College in Arkansas, but dropped out after she got divorced. Undaunted by her divorce, she married another guy, Elmer Stevens, almost a year later. And that marriage lasted exactly 3 days, from March 12th through March 14th, though their divorce was finalized in August. Nothing really is known of either Dickens or Stevens. They vanished out of history. Lynetta tried taking classes at a business school, but without a husband providing financial support, she had to go to work. Despite being good at writing, in quotation marks, and math, in quotation marks, the best she could do was a factory job, which in the 1920s Midwest paid about a dollar a day. Lynetta's father had died. She never elaborated on the specific cause or date of his demise. So her mother, Mary, lived with Lynetta during her marriage to Cecil Dickinson. But not long after Lynetta divorced her second husband and struck out on her own, Mary Putnam became ill, probably with TB, tuberculosis, and she died in 1925. So a year later, Lynetta found her third husband and married again. And her approach to this third marriage was more pragmatic. Though she yearned to be a great lady, she was currently working for a company in Evansville, Indiana. Which kind of cut in on her imagining she's a great woman time. Typically, Lynetta later bragged that, "I started as a secretary and in 1 year I became a top aide." But the reality was that she found herself stuck in another shit-paying, dead-end job where there was no prayer of advancement, especially for a woman, especially for an uneducated woman. Her health was also suffering, and she later admitted to some kind of lung condition. Historian Joyce Overman Bowman has found evidence that Lynetta was treated, probably for TB also, in an Illinois sanitarium. Lynetta, more than anything, wanted security, a life of sufficient ease wherein she could exercise her great intellectual and spiritual gifts and realize her full potential to be a great woman. So the obvious solution was marrying a better man, marrying well, so to speak, choosing a man with a family fortune that would allow her to live in a gracious rather than bare subsistence manner. And sometime in 1926, Lynetta believed that she'd found him. John Henry Jones. Isn't that Indiana Jones' name? No, Henry Jones Jr. John Henry Jones was prominent in Randolph County, Indiana, both for his extensive farmland holdings and for his politics. He proudly proclaimed himself a Democrat in a region where virtually everybody else was a fervent Republican. John Henry, a devout Quaker, presided over a large family. His two marriages produced 13 children. Their father expected them to make something of themselves, and most of them did. The majority, daughters as well as sons, graduated from college. John Henry sold off spare acreage to pay for their tuition. As adults, several settled into the same area where they had grown up. It was Randolph County, and it was tucked just near the Ohio border. Jones' offspring worked in managerial capacities for the railroad. They farmed, taught school, or else owned and operated local businesses. Gas station, beer gardens, so on and so forth. One ran the county home for orphan children. In only two cases did they fail to flourish. Billy took up with a bad crowd and fell prey to drinking and gambling. His father mourned such dissolute ways but didn't disown him. And then there was Jim, born in October 1887 and christened James Thurman Jones I, who went off to war and returned a fucking train wreck. Practically from birth, Jim disappointed his father. Though he was a nice enough kid, he had no ambition. He got basic grade school education, but wasn't interested in anything higher. Like his father and brother, he was handy with tools and every kind of machinery, so he ended up working on road crews all around the state. And because automobiles were beginning to proliferate, there was always plenty of work. It was steady, if unexciting, but at least it was consistent employment, which suited easygoing Jim exactly. It was surprising that Jim didn't marry, because most of Randolph County contemporaries paired off pretty early, often in high school, and started families, but he didn't. Perhaps because he had the same lack of ambition and romance as in the rest of his life, Jim was 30 the first time that he'd ever shown any attraction to a woman, or any gumption for that matter, any fucking ambition. And when America entered World War I, he enlisted in the army and was sent to fight, oh man, on the front lines in France as a meat shield. And there he was, caught in a German gas attack. The insidious vapors burned deep into his lungs, and then as quickly as he was deployed, Jim was sent home, a shadow already of his former self. Those mustard gas attacks were fucking brutal. It was difficult for him to catch a full breath, and his respiratory system continued deteriorating for the rest of his life. Jim's voice was reduced to a raspy croak. He didn't talk much, and when he did, he was hard to understand. As a disabled veteran, and one of about 70,000 Americans victimized... Only 70,000, I thought it would have been more. Victimized by gas in World War I, Jim was eligible for a military pension. Though it probably only amounted to about $30 a month, it wasn't enough to live on. So, back in civilian life, Jim returned to work on the road crews. But he wasn't really able to handle physical labor anymore. He tried, but he just couldn't do it. He also developed rheumatism and had to periodically take time off. Single and in constant discomfort and rapidly approaching his middle ages, Jim was getting pretty lonely. It was getting dark. So then while working with a road crew around Evansville, he met an outgoing woman that was named Lynette, though she also called herself Lynetta. She was either 15 or 17 years younger than Jim, and to the astonishment of the groom's family, who assumed Jim to be a lifelong bachelor, they married on December 20th, 1926, almost a year to the day after the death of the bride's mother. So, though she was now saddled with a disabled husband nearly old enough to be her father, Lynetta was still pleased to have married, she was still pleased to have married into a prominent family, which was all she'd really wanted. She expected that now she would assume a more appropriate, even a pampered position in life, and she was mistaken. She could blow it out her ass. The newlyweds needed a place to live, and Lynetta's new father-in-law did give them one, making a down payment on a small farm in Crete, not the Mediterranean island, which was just a short distance north of Lynn. And Lynn was where most of the Jones family lived, but John Henry Jones didn't provide anything beyond that, though he had the financial wherewithal to give them the land outright. And thanks to him, his son and daughter-in-law now had property and had the opportunity to make something of it. Hell of a start. But the rest was up to them. They floundered from the start. There were corn and soybeans to plant and tend, and hogs to raise, slaughter, and sell. And despite her claims of a childhood spent trampling the woods and trapping animals, Lynetta, in fact, was not very good with animals. She had no experience in animal husbandry, let alone the knowledge of how to plow furrows or care for the harvest or do anything with crop. Her husband, Jim, was more familiar with the daily demands of farming, but he often wasn't on the property. He was disturbed. He saw a lot of shit. He gets a break from me, man. That must have been terrible. Money was needed for seeds and tools and animal feeds, so he worked on the road crews around the state from time to time. And that kept Jim away for days or even weeks at a time, leaving Lynetta all on her own. And her work would have been easier with the newfangled farm machinery, but she and Jim couldn't afford it. When Jim was home and tried pitching in on the endless chores, he tired quickly and had to sit down or even take off and go to bed. Lynetta couldn't have any extended conversations with her husband because of his respiratory problems. And in another location, she might have turned to her neighbors for socializing, but there weren't many. Crete was a collection of a half dozen farms and a grain elevator. Its population was about 28. Four times a day, trains passed through, two whizzing by nonstop with passengers, and the other pair pausing to load grain brought daily to the elevator by area farmers. So it didn't really make Crete a village as much as it was like a stopping place. Like, well, this here is a decent place to take a shit, but you want to stop in the next town over to get your biscuits. So the cargo trains also hauled coal, and as soon as they pulled away, Crete's residents stopped whatever they were doing and hustled to the tracks, picking up any chunks that had fallen off the cars. Even though Lynn, with its shops and grocery stores, was nearby, everybody in Crete did their best to live off the land, raising their own food and supplementing diets by picking the strawberries and raspberries that grew wild near the tracks. And they called it living smart. But Jim couldn't pick berries, and Lynetta wore herself down until the point where she just usually wouldn't do it. So their meals were sparse and unappealing. Anything beyond basic cooking required energy and commitment that she didn't have or refused to give. And the other few families in Crete felt sorry for them, because Jim was a disabled war veteran, after all. But they had all they could do. But they had all they could do fending for themselves, and everybody was wary of Lynetta. She blatantly defied local custom by smoking in public instead of the privacy of her own home. She also swore like a fucking sailor when she felt like it, no matter who was in earshot. Lynetta seemed to enjoy the resulting stares. If she couldn't be happy, at least she could be different. Jesus Christ. At weekend gatherings of the Jones clan in Lynn, instead of enjoying these opportunities to socialize, Lynetta saw women with nice houses and fine things and burned with resentment. She hated her life on the Crete farm so much and yearned for a much more lucrative way to meet the tremendously high goals that she'd set for herself. But bad as things were in the beginning, over the next few years, they only got to be worse. Jim's health didn't get any better. He had to give up working on the road crews, so the Jones family income dropped accordingly. He also couldn't really do anything to help Lynetta with the farm, and what he did try to do often wasn't helpful at all. If Lynetta had any previous respect for her husband, it was now gone. The man knew nothing about stock or farming. They couldn't afford seed, let alone hired help. So bills piled up. Meeting the mortgage was a monthly challenge. She would have been glad to escape, but she considered this a type of slavery, but she had nowhere to go. On the farm, at least, there was food, and unless some miracle occurred, Lynetta and Jim would not have the farm that much longer. The most obvious source of financial rescue remained John Henry, her father-in-law. He'd suffered his own depression-related financial reversals and now lived part of the time with the son's family in Lynn, and other times on his remaining acreage in Crete. But he was still reasonably well off, and so were most of the other Joneses. They'd been set up well. Maybe they'd taken Jim if the farm was lost, but for all Lynetta knew, they'd gladly see her homeless and in a breadline. She felt certain that they disliked her, which wasn't true at all. Lynetta's quirky personality could be off-putting, but most of her in-laws admired her balls. Letting Lynetta and Jim struggle to make it on their own was a sign of respect. She didn't see that, though, and she believed something needed to be done to win their sympathy to make them more inclined to help. Lynetta had absolutely no maternal instincts at all. She never wanted or intended to become a mother. Later, she would weave a tale of becoming ill and falling into a fevered dream, of approaching the Egyptian River of Death, and as Lynetta was about to cross it, perishing in the process, the spirit of her mother appeared and told her that she could not die because it was her destiny to give birth to a child who would become a great man. Whether it was due to destiny or desperation, in the fall of 1930, Lynetta announced that she was, in fact, with child. She gave birth in a Crete farmhouse on May 13th, 1931, to James Warren Jones. But, besides saddling Lynetta with even more responsibility, the arrival of the child changed nothing. Jim, the baby's father, never articulated the frustration he surely felt from his escalating physical problems to an unhappy wife who was constantly critical of him and the rest of his family. But soon after the child's birth, Jim snapped from the stress, suffering a complete breakdown that required months of hospitalization in nearby Oxford, Ohio. An attending physician described Jim as nervous, emotional, irritable, nervous system and general physical conditions below par. Even after being sent home, Jim required a periodic return visit and treatment. He could not focus on the problems that his wife had no choice to face on her own, in particular, keeping ownership of their property. Lynetta was unsympathetic. What kind of man surrendered to the heebie-jeebies? Later in Jonestown, she would scornfully write, "My husband, having cried tears of disappointment, was resigned to letting the mortgager take the farm." Lynetta recounted a confrontation in 1934 between herself and a representative of the bank, whom she said was ordered to throw her family out of their house and off their land. And in her tale, she refused to leave until guaranteed a house in Lynn. "I intend to have a roof over my child's head come hell or high water. Tell your boss I don't know how to play the role of worm, and I'm not fixing to learn." The reality was just that the other Joneses stepped in. A house, not a fancy house, but perfectly adequate, was found in Lynn for Jim, Lynetta, and Jimmy. Little Jimmy. And that's what they called the young, new child. That's what they called fucking Jim Jones. It was on Grant Street, where two of Jim's brothers already lived. Jim's army pension would have been put towards the rent, and also whatever occasional wage he might earn, should his health permit it. And his father and brothers would assume the remaining financial responsibility, and that was fine with Lynetta. But then the Jones brothers set out what they expected of her, and while her son was a toddler, she could stay home and raise him. But once the child started school, Lynetta's in-laws would continue helping out financially, but only if she found a job and earned the bulk of the necessary household income. She didn't have a choice. Jim, Lynetta, and Jimmy, they all moved to Lynn. Lynn, Indiana was a crossroads town. State Road 27 and 36 intersected here. New York Central and Pennsylvania Railroads passed through it. Most of its 950 or so residents were part of families that lived in or around Randolph County for generations. Everyone was up everyone else's ass. It was virtually impossible to keep secrets. Living there involved an unspoken but understood obligation to fit in. Conformity was the bedrock of good citizenship. In part, Lynn existed to serve the needs of the farmers whose acreage ringed the town. Country folk came in on Saturdays to trade goods, milk, butter, eggs, fresh beef, and poultry for things that they couldn't grow or make themselves. Lynn offered them the services of a doctor, dentist, and veterinarian, who were often paid in chickens or in homemade pies. Good trade. There were a few grocery stores in Lynn, as well as a barber shop, a cafe or two, a drugstore, a daily newspaper, a pool room, and several churches, which reflected the integral role religion played. As in the rest of traditionally conservative state, evangelical Protestantism reigned. Lynn had small Methodist Disciples of Christ and Nazarene and Quaker churches, but no Catholic churches. If any Catholics lived in Lynn, they kept that shit to themselves and went to Mass somewhere else. Overall, the town of Lynn was a friendly place. People living there worked hard to keep it that way, and those who were better off didn't flaunt it. Everyone dressed the same, clean clothes, but nothing fancy. Parents kept an eye on their own kids and everybody else's. No one locked their doors when they went out, secure in the knowledge that nobody from Lynn would steal. and that their neighbors would be on the lookout for any suspicious strangers. There was a comforting sense of shared schedules, and on Wednesday nights in nice weather, everybody gathered downtown to watch free movies shown on the sheet tacked up on the side of a building, usually westerns, with their inevitable good guys whipping the bad guys in the plot line. Those are usually the most popular. Saturdays were shopping days, Sundays meant church, and everybody in town went. There were no rivalries between preachers or congregations, and often on major holidays, Lynn's ministers would combine their flocks for collaborative services. Every Friday during the last class period, Lynn high schoolers gathered in the gym, where the town preachers took turns giving hour-long talks on living right and growing up clean. For fun, a lot of men in Lynn had social clubs. The Odd Fellows and the Red Men's Lodges were popular, and in 1930s, the Masons were the most prominent, though in the 1910s and 20s, the KKK was the most prominent. That's the Ku Klux Klan. The power base of the Klan had drifted north into Indiana and became the largest organization of any kind in the state. In a single year, from July 1922 to 23, it registered Indiana membership ballooned from 445 to almost 118,000. Unlike its focus in the South, the Klan in Indiana spent little time promoting racial hatred. There weren't enough black people in Indiana, less than 3%. It didn't make any sense to preach it that way. So maintaining white supremacy and racial purity was always part of any Klan agenda. But instead, the Indiana Klan stressed better public education and prohibition, both issues that played well throughout the state, particularly in rural areas. Klan leaders cannily insinuated their group into small towns by sponsoring community picnics and parades, paying for everything, and leaving the impression that they too were decent people with similar conservative Christian values. Prohibition in America, mandated by the 18th Amendment in 1920, was repealed in 1933, but that made no difference in Randolph County or in Lynn, which remained dry counties. Lynn preachers thundered against liquor, and in such small, insular place, it was impossible to sneak a drink without everybody else finding out. Even getting that liquor would involve taking the bus across state lines into Ohio, and the few bootleggers in the area knew better than to ply their wares around Lynn. The town pool hall, considered sinful by some because of the dime bet card games, did not serve alcohol either. No one did. To this day, locals apologize for liquor stores in the nearby towns. They even feel tainted by their proximity close to the town. Lynn's public schools stood out in the best way possible. For decades, children in Indiana received minimal education in the one-room schoolhouses, with the students of all ages lumped together and often instructed by teachers who have never graduated from high school themselves. But around 1910, Randolph County hired Dr. Lee Driver to restructure its public school system. Driver was a dynamo who consolidated all the one-room classrooms into full-fledged town schools, including one in Lynn. Transportation was also provided. Instead of walking long distances to and from school, farm kids were picked up and brought home by bus for the first time, and they attended regularly. Drivers insisted on structured curriculum and used grant money to hire qualified teachers. High school graduation rates soon skyrocketed by 70%, and those kids actually learned enough to qualify for decent jobs or even admission to college. Driver was eventually hired by Pennsylvania to work the same miracles for its public schools. And by then, the reputation of Randolph County schools was such that delegations from Canada and China, as well as other U.S. states, came to study its school system and adapt its programs to their own. Students in Randolph County were fortunate, and especially in Lynn, where the courses were available in foreign languages, including Latin. Wow. And it also had advanced math and science, and for the first time in memory, the Lynn Bulldogs had potential career opportunities beyond farming or factory work. Some went on to become architects, doctors, or even educators themselves. The Depression brought one huge change to Lynn's population, and that was it skewed the younger. Previously, the majority of the residents were older, most often married people who had owned farms and raised families, and when the parents reached their late 50s or early 60s and could no longer handle the hard physical labor required, they turned the farms over to their kids and moved into town. By the early 1930s, terrible economic times found many younger couples forced off their farms and moving into Lynn with their children. The town assimilated them easily enough, and most had relatives or friends already living there. Newly arrived husbands took factory work in Winchester or Richmond, the nearest big towns, and young mothers kept house and raised children. These new arrivals automatically fell into all the familiar Lynn ways. Jim, Lynetta, and Jimmy Warren Jones, part of the esteemed Jones clan, were expected to do the same, and they didn't.
And now, a quick word from one of the people that is not sponsoring this episode.
We may be crazy, but we're not stupid. At Crazy Gideon's.
I tuck them deep and sell them cheap. If you don't buy from me, we're both losing money. Call me before. Drive a little Sevelos. I'm insane. I want to sell the merchandise. I love you. Wow. If you don't buy from me, you're crazy.
And we're back. The townspeople were ready to embrace Jim and Lynetta Jones and their little boy. Everybody already knew Jimba. He'd been raised in Crete. He'd always been considered a nice little boy, and there was a universal sympathy and respect for his dad and his post-war disability, so everyone gave the Joneses quite a bit of room. Most Lynn residents had their doubts about the government, but not the country itself. Patriots, they were all, and they all honored Jim for his service, and they wanted to do what they could for him in the present. Some part-time work was found for him in one of the railroad offices. Simple, clerical tasks, since now he couldn't even stand up for a long period of time. Family and generous neighbors helped the Jones set up in their new house on Grant Street, and as town residencies went, it was neither distinguished nor dilapidated. It was just an ordinary house, and there should have been no reason, good or bad, why living there would have been any particular way. Had an ordinary frame structure with a pleasant porch, and Jim liked to sit out there in the evenings. There was also a garage, because Jim and Lynetta had a car. It was a hand-me-down from some sibling or other, but it still was transportation. And lots of families in Lynn didn't have cars and had to rely on the buses when they needed to get anywhere, when they needed to get anywhere beyond walking distance, that is. And above the garage was a loft, useful for storage, but Jim and Lynetta didn't have a lot to store. So a lot of space. The Grant Street house was minimally furnished with gently used furniture, either trucked down from the lost farm in Crete or else donated by members of Jim's extended family. So they had all the basics. Dining room table, chairs, bed for Jim, Lynetta, a crib for Jimmy, and a great deal could have been done to make the place more attractive, but that was the wife's responsibility, and Lynetta had no knack for or interest in decorating. The rest of Lynn wasn't automatically condemning of such bare-bones housekeeping, and in this community of no secrets, everybody knew the other Joneses were subsidizing Jim and Lynetta. The lack of furniture, household amenities, and traditional meals could be chalked up to pride. Jim and Lynetta probably didn't want to take one more cent from his relatives, but they had to keep doing it. Still, Lynetta dreamed of a finer life. She fancied herself a writer and thought she had been one in a previous life, and she became obsessed with the reincarnation thing. She wanted conversation devoted to grand things, reincarnation, progressive metaphysics, non-conservative politics, not boring chatter about drapery and pie recipes. So she spurned invitations to visit other women in town and never invited them into her home. Even out in public, shopping or attending Wednesday night community movie, Lynetta rarely spoke to anybody, and when she did, she kept conversation minimal. Many felt that she was taking on the air, that she was better than everybody, and it pissed them off because this bitch couldn't keep a decent house. but Lynetta simply didn't have anything to talk to them about and felt there was no basis for friendships. Lynetta couldn't avoid spending time with the rest of her husband's family, though. Without them, her and her husband and son would have been completely homeless. But she was sensitive to every word they spoke to or about her, always anticipating insults. It was particularly galling that they constantly called her Lynette rather than Lynetta. When they first met her, she still called herself Lynette much of the time, and that was how they managed to continue addressing her that way. They didn't mean any offense and certainly would have obliged if she'd asked them to call her Lynetta, but she hadn't, preferring to assume it was a deliberate insult. Constantly frustrated, unable in any tangible way to fulfill her ambition of being a great woman, Lynetta got through her dreary days by nurturing resentments, imagining confrontations where she triumphed over enemies through wit and courage. And Lynetta later wrote colorful accounts of these fantasies, substituting self-fabricated fiction for fact. But during these years, in Lynn, her only audience was her small son, young Jimba. And he learned his earliest and most enduring lessons from his mother in these years. There were two of them. There was always some of them out to get you, and reality was whatever you believed. Even after moving to Lynn, Jim's health continued to fail. That's old Jim Sr. He suffered periodic physical and emotional breakdowns. Besides scheduled visits to the hospital in Ohio, sometimes one of his brothers would drive him into Dayton, Virginia Hospital for emergency treatment. Jim coughed constantly. His respiratory problems weren't helped by his chain smoking. He always seemed to have a cigarette dangling from his mouth. His posture over time became stooped, and he stopped occasionally working for the railroad. In the mornings, he dragged himself onto the porch and sometimes sat there all day, and people felt very sorry for him. They waved sadly when they walked by and called out greetings, and Jim responded by coughing at him. He could talk better some days than others, but he was definitely a friendly guy. Town children liked Jim because, unlike many grown-ups, he always called them by name. Up close, his appearance was kind of startling. Though he was still in his mid-40s, his face had become a mass of wrinkles and sagging skin. And before, he'd been known around town as Big Jim to distinguish him from his son Jimmy. But now, some in Lynn began calling him Old Jim instead. Lynetta continued to keep to herself, and when she did venture into the main part of town, she made a spectacle of herself by smoking and wearing pants instead of a dress. People stared, and she glared back. When she did talk to grocers or store clerks or to the passerby she absolutely had to greet, she peppered her conversations with swear words. But in defense of this bitch, damn and hell were swear words of the time, and that's what Lynetta used all the time. Occasionally, there was bullshit. She never understood why her cursing upset so many people. They were just words. But it amused her whenever her swearing bothered someone, and it often did, so she continued to exploit that. To an extent, everyone else in Lynn could accept even this eccentricity. But there was one thing about Jim and Lynetta Jones that set them apart in a crucial way. In a town where everyone else went to church on Sundays, they never did. And for this, they might have been ostracized by many devout townspeople that they... That's a mortal sin, man. They weren't... It was due mostly to respect... The fact that they weren't ostracized, it was due mostly to respect for the rest of the Jones family, who could be found at every Sunday Mass, dutifully attending all the Quaker services. And also out of appreciation for old Jim's war service, but it still pissed everyone off greatly. The time finally came in the fall of 1936, when little Jimmy was old enough to start the first grade. Lynetta had to get a job, as was the agreement. The area factories were hiring, and it was mostly a matter of where she wanted to work. Later, Lynetta spun a tale of persecution by her in-laws. Now, she believed they resented her for the many prospective employers clamoring to employ her. That, in fact, they really didn't want her to go to work at all. My husband's family felt that one's character, if a housewife was dwarfed by working outside the home, especially if she was so skillful and if her services were as much in demand as mine. Oh, man. Lynetta hired on at a glass factory in Winchester. Every morning, she got up and took the bus to work. Before she left, she gave Jimmy a sandwich in a sack and sent him off to school. She left her husband to his own devices, and old Jim mostly filled his time by shuffling downtown to the pool hall. It was either that or sitting alone in his dreary house. When he got to the pool hall, he would play cards and drink coffee or soda all day. The owner of the place abided by Lynn custom and did not serve alcohol, so it was a dry pool hall. At nights and on weekends when all three Joneses were home, they had few visitors, mostly family members dropping off food. Lynetta, usually being too weary or agitated to cook, or else kids from the immediate neighborhood who came by to play with Jimmy but left soon afterwards, spooked by the forbidding atmosphere. Nobody ever seemed to talk at the house but Mrs. Jones, and this always took the form of some diatribe rather than a conversation. She'd be hollering at Mr. Jones or at Jimmy, or else cussing up a storm about the mean sons of bitches at work who didn't mind working a woman half to goddamn death. She didn't care who else was there to hear her. No other woman in Lynn took on so. No other husband would have tolerated it. Still, after 2.5 years, people in Lynn were used to old Jim and Lynetta or Lynette or Ludnit, whatever the fuck her name was. The couple was odd, no doubt about it, but now, for the first time, little Jimmy Jones was loose on the town streets, and it soon became apparent that compared to the boy, the parents were pretty much normal. One weekend morning, 12-year-old Max Knight and his dad drove toward the central part of Lynn. Mr. Knight operated a small airport just outside of town, and he always had weekend work to do, and Max liked going with him watching the planes. They were mostly crop dusters, and they would take off and land, and he enjoyed watching it. He thought it was fun. As they approached downtown, Max saw a much younger boy, he guessed the kid was 6, walking on the side of the road, and a beagle trailed after him. Beagle looked a lot like Max's dog. Mr. Knight agreed the resemblance was amazing and pulled the car over so Max could hop out and get a better look. The minute that Max did, the smaller boy ran away and the beagle right at his heels. Max didn't want the kid to be scared. He ran after him, yelling for him to stop. The chase lasted about a block and a half before the smaller boy tried to hide behind a tree, but Max was not fooled. He came up to the kid and was surprised to see that he was trembling. Almost 80 years later, Max described him as petrified for some reason, just scared to death. Max introduced himself, and the other boy said his name was Jimmy. Max said, "I've got a dog that looks like your dog." Jimmy seemed to think he was being accused of pet theft, and he said defensively, "It ain't my dog. It belongs to a neighbor, and it just followed me." Max felt bad. He hadn't meant to upset anyone. He just wanted to get a better glimpse at the beagle that looked like his dog. Changing the subject, he mentioned that he was out riding around with his dad, who ran the airport, and Jimmy's eyes lit up when he heard that. He said he loved airplanes. Max said Jimmy ought to come by the airport sometime so he could see the planes up close. And the next thing Max and his dad knew, Jimmy was at the airport every fucking weekend, butting up to Max and telling Mr. McKnight that he wanted to be a pilot, wanted to fly airplanes himself someday. And of course, when anybody expresses interest in your hobbies, it pleased Mr. McKnight, or Mr. Knight. Lots of local kids like to hang out on the periphery of the airport and watch the planes, but because Mr. Knight was so impressed with him, Jimmy got special privileges. He was allowed to go up to the planes and touch them and talk with the pilots as they prepped the aircraft for flight. And soon, there was no doubt in Mr. Knight's mind that Jimmy Jones loved airplanes more than anything else in the world, and the youngster meant it when he said that. And thanks to Mr. Knight, he would become a pilot when he grew up. Max Knight started thinking of Jimmy as a little brother. Their age difference kept them from becoming running buddies, but whenever he was in downtown Lynn, Max made a point of looking up his little pal Jimmy and seeing how he was doing. Jimmy hinted at a bad home life, mostly due to a mean father who scared him. Jimmy was so obviously needy that Max couldn't help liking and wanting to protect him. And now a few more words from somebody else that does not sponsor me.
Does the shoulder strap in your car cut into your shoulder? When you travel, is your shoulder strap too tight and annoying? Introducing the Titty Bear. That's T-I-D-D-Y Bear, the cute little guy that eliminates all those irritating shoulder strap problems. Designed to make driving more comfortable, the Titty Bear snaps onto your shoulder strap and moves up and down to eliminate uncomfortable pressure wherever you need it.
My shoulder strap used to pull so tight I could hardly breathe. Now with the Titty Bear, I really enjoy traveling again.
With a patent-pending swivel design, you can easily adjust the titty bear to work from either the driver's side, passenger seat, or infant car seat. And it fits on all makes and models. Just snap it on, slide it to where it relieves the pressure, and you're ready for a comfortable ride.
How about that? And we're back. Jimmy Jones had already spent considerable time scampering along Lynn streets before he started grade school, and there was nothing unusual about this at the time. From the time that he could walk, and from the time that most little boys could walk for that matter, the little boys in town ran all over the place. It was considered part of the natural cycle of growing up. Yes, kids, because it used to be socially acceptable to allow your children to play outside and not on a computer. First, they'd stick to a block or two around their homes. I remember this with my bike, man. Then gradually branch out into the neighborhood. And finally, when they were old enough for the first grade, they'd walk to school and back. From there, it was on to the fields and woods surrounding town, always on foot until 10th or 11th birthday, when the gift of a bicycle greatly expanded their range. Oh man, I remember riding my bike fucking everywhere. I used to love that. Parents didn't worry about them because every grown-up in town watched them. So, he grew up in a pretty safe town. Everything changed for him, and changed significantly once he started the first grade, and his mother was at work all day, and his father still haunted the pool hall. So, he was growing up. And from the day that she started at the Winchester Glass Factory, Lynetta had a rule, and that was that Jimmy was not to come into their house until she got home. This edict quickly became known all over town, and nobody understood why. Nobody was friendly enough with Lynetta to ask, but it was weird. It made the people feel really bad for Jimmy, whose relatives' homes were always open to him, but Jimmy seldom ended up there. Instead, he wandered Lynn streets looking lonely and sad and helpless. The little waif's plight seemed obvious, and around town, the ladies outside of the Jones family did the natural thing and invited him into their home for snacks or even full meals when he said that he was really hungry. Jimmy swore to each that her food was the most delicious and the best he'd ever tasted. Jimmy was such a polite child, grateful for the slightest kindness, so everyone jumped at the opportunity to help him. And almost every lady ended up feeling that she had a special bond with Jimmy. The boys seemed to find something in common with each one of them and shared interest in flowers or animals or crafted goods, whatever it was. And this proved especially true for old Myrtle Kennedy. Myrtle was a scarecrow of a woman, 6 feet, 2 inches tall, and self-conscious about it, and it was in a small town where everybody was religious, and Myrtle took faith to the extremes. Orville, her husband, pastored Lynn's Nazarene Church. The Nazarenes were conservative in terms of social behavior, meaning no dancing, no drinking, no swearing, and Nazarene women never wore sleeveless or short dresses in fear of inflaming the sinful lust of men. And that teaching perpetuates the problem. In Lynn, nobody tried to woo anyone else from one church to another, except for Myrtle. She was the exception. To her, it was join the Nazarenes or you are going straight to hell. Those were the options. Nazarenes or hell. On Sunday afternoon, she was known to the buttonhole people on the streets. Or she was known to buttonhole people on the streets and ask if they'd been to church that day. Oh, fuck you, bitch. She sure hadn't seen them in the Nazarene service, and they should have been there. Nothing delighted her more than the baptismal dunking of a convert in the nearby river. People forgave Myrtle for her zealotry because in every other way she was a lovely old lady, and no one in Lynn was more generous to the needy than her. At least she lived what she was preaching. And because the train and a couple of highways ran through Lynn in the depressed 1930s, there were always tramps around town, always transients. And they were all carefully monitored by the residents. Questionable ones were hustled out of the town and on their way, but harmless indigents, down on their luck, were usually fed. No one was more generous to these hobos than Myrtle. She was renowned for baking dozens of pies and setting warm slices out on the sill of an open window so that passing transients could help themselves. That is strangely kind. Along with the food came an obligation to listen a while to Myrtle espousing the Nazarene faith. She claimed that joining her church was the only way to guarantee glory in the next life, if not this one. But it was a testament to Myrtle's goodness that she kept putting out pies, even though none of these tramps were ever converted. In little Jimmy Jones' case, though, Myrtle sensed huge Nazarene potential. After all, the child had no church. His parents never took him on Sunday, so he was growing up godless. He was an attractive kid, too. Dark-haired, dark-eyed, like his mother, but with none of her bullshit standoffishness. The Kennedys lived directly across Grant Street from old Jim and Lynetta, and every day, Myrtle saw poor Jimmy out wandering, and it was only natural for her to invite him in and stuff him with pie when he was hungry, which was pretty much all the time. Supposedly, his mother gave him a sandwich to tide him over during the day, but every time Myrtle asked if he'd had something to eat, Jimmy said no. And the precious little boy could never lie to her. So she thought. Once the pie was consumed, Myrtle took the opportunity to share with Jimmy the good word of Jesus Christ. However, he wanted everybody to be a Nazarene. Unenlightened people thought the Nazarene rules were far too restrictive, but all of them were fucking sinners, and all the rules did was hold everybody to a distinct set of standards set down in the Bible. Yep, homophobia and all. Myrtle read to Jimmy from the good book. He hung on every word and remembered what he heard. He had a gift for that. He had a memory like a motherfucker. Soon, he was quoting scripture back to her, and she was exhilarated. From there, her next step was taking Jimmy to church with her on Sundays. His mom didn't care. She was always worn out from her weekday work. And if this busybody neighbor wanted to tote Jimmy off for the morning, one less hassle that Lynetta had to worry about on her day off. So every Sunday, Jimmy went to the Nazarene church with Mrs. Kennedy and listened to Mr. Kennedy talk about the Lord and all the things he didn't want you to do. After a while, Jimmy started spending occasional nights at the Kennedy's house, and that was all right with his mother, too, because she only had disdain for those who believed in something as simple as a God up in the sky, who eventually consigned everybody to heaven or hell, depending on his mood. Lynetta's spiritualism was far richer than that, involving reincarnation, one life after another, the idea of destiny. Sometimes, in a life which was not the only life, a person's grand destiny was thwarted by those unappreciative or jealous of somebody and their superiority, or their potential superiority. And she believed that that was currently happening to her, but her son, in his present incarnation, was going to be great. She was certain of it. Greatness wouldn't include falling for Myrtle Kennedy's Nazarene bullshit. Lynetta probably mentioned this to Jimmy now and again, but just to be certain that the boy wasn't being duped. Beyond that, let him spend time with old Lady Kennedy, go to church with her, kept Jimmy out of his mother's hair, and besides, in the grand cosmic scheme of things, Lynetta didn't think it would make a fuck of a difference anyway. But when Myrtle brought Jimmy back to church, he loved it. The child showed an amazing knack for remembering everything he heard there, and the scriptural readings, especially. Within weeks, he could repeat lengthy biblical passage verbatim. He couldn't wait for Sunday so he could go to church with Mrs. Kennedy, and privately, he began calling her Mom. Myrtle was ecstatic. She'd saved a soul for Jesus Christ, her Lord and Savior, and now she'd reap her deserved reward. Watching the boy as he grew into God's grace and in the biblically mandated Nazarene way, and then things took an unexpected turn. Jimmy enjoyed the Nazarene service, but was curious about the other town churches too, so he began attending some of the other revival meetings that regularly occurred in the area. Oh man, all the local faiths hosted them, and there were some revivals by non-affiliated preachers too. For those of you are unfamiliar with what this is, it's essentially the fucking circus performers of religious folks, and they go from town to town putting on a show and a spectacle, and people speak in tongues and get compelled to move by the Holy Spirit and fall over on themselves and look like they're having epileptic fits or seizures. I don't fully understand what's going on. A lot of speaking in nonsense, a lot of Lemurian talking. Gibberish. But whatever. So after that, the occasional Sundays... So they had the revivals, and after that, occasional Sundays found Jimmy in Lynn's Methodist Church, or with the Quakers or Disciples of Christ. Over the next few years, he joined them all, being baptized by the ones that required it, swearing other forms of allegiance to those that didn't. Jimmy studied everything. There were Sundays when he spent part of the morning in one church service, then scampered out to catch the tail end of a different one. That certainly caught the attention of just about everyone in Lynn, because it turned out that the little Jones boy was just as weird as his parents, though at least in a positive way. Hopefully at some point he'd settle down and pick a church for good. Meanwhile, at least he was going, which was more than could be said for his mom and dad, which still drove everyone fucking up a tree. Jimmy learned alienation from his mother, and that was the art of making others feel that they had beliefs and hopes in common, and it was, the art of making others feel that they had beliefs and hopes in common, and it was a gift all his own. And even as a small child, he had a talent for explaining away actions that seemingly contradicted what he said. This was evident in his relationship with Myrtle Kennedy. After he began attending other churches besides the Nazarene, with anyone else, Myrtle would have felt hurt or betrayed. She'd set the child's feet down on the right path, and he'd wandered off it, but Jimmy somehow managed to retain her affection. Whatever he explained to her, perhaps that he just attended the other churches to see firsthand how they expressed the faith, it worked because Myrtle continued doting on the boy. Later, it would often be said that Jim Jones used others without scruple, cold-heartedly conning his way to whatever he wanted and never really caring for anybody, even those who'd helped him more than anybody else. In many instances, there was ample proof of this, but not in the case of Myrtle Kennedy. After Jimmy left Lynn and his life took many surprising turns, he never lost contact with the Nazarene woman who once took to him. And from the big city of Indianapolis onto California, where he became famous, even from the jungles of Guyana, every week or two in his adult life, Jim Jones sat down and scribbled a note to Myrtle Kennedy, sharing with her sanitized versions of what he was up to and expressing hopes that she was well. There was nothing in it for him beyond making certain that Myrtle knew he'd never forgotten her and that he remained grateful for her kindness. Weird. And now, another message from somebody else that's not sponsoring this episode.
Do you want to feel so energetic? Try Power Thirst. Energy drinks for people who need gratuitous amounts of energy. With all new flavors like chocolate. Chocolate energy. It's like adding chocolate to an electrical store. Sound the alarm. You're going to be uncomfortably energetic. What's that? You want strawberry? Well, how about rawberry? Made with lightning. Real lightning. Sports. You'll be good at them. It's an energy drink for men. Energy. These aren't your dad's puns. These are energy puns. Turbo puns. Science, energy, electrolytes, turbo lights, power lights, more lights than your body has room for. You'll be so fast, Mother Nature will be like, slow down. And you'll be like, fuck you, and kick her in the face with your energy legs. You'll have so much energy. Just running all the time. Power running, power lifting, power sleeping, power dating, power eating, power laughing, power spawning babies. You'll have so many babies. 400 babies. Give chocolate to your babies and they'll be good at sports. Make your babies run abnormally fast. They'll run as fast as canyons. People will watch them running and think they're canyons. They'll race as fast as canyons against actual canyons, and it'll be a tie and they'll get deported back to Kenya. Hey, go with the sure thing. Don't gamble on your energy.
Snake eyes.
Try Power Thirst, the energy drink that will make you sport.
In September of 1977, Jim Jones would claim in an interview intended as part of a memoir that he'd never actually believed in God. He'd seen religion purely as an opportunity to infiltrate the church and turn Christians towards socialism. Maybe it was true, but there's no way to look into somebody's heart and know the truth about their faith or lack thereof. It's also possible to believe fervently as a child, and lose belief completely as an adult, and claim never to have believed at all. But of young Jimmy's early attraction to religion, there was no doubt. To a child who, by Jones' own later admission, sought approval so fucking much, the church offered a perfect life goal. Remember Max Knight, who lived nearby in Spartanburg? Whenever he was in Lynn, he dropped by to see his little buddy, then check in on him. Once he knocked on the door and nobody was home, so Max looked for Jimmy across the street at Mrs. Kennedy's house. He thought she was Jimmy's grandma because his pal was over there so much, and there was obvious affection between the two of them. Mrs. Kennedy said that Jimmy was probably playing in the nearby woods. Max had some time, so he wandered over there, poking around until he finally heard a loud voice off in the trees, and he walked in that direction and stumbled upon Jimmy. The little boy didn't notice Max because his back was to him. Jimmy was standing on a stump, hand pressed over his heart, preaching. Max remembered it as really putting on a show, all about how Jesus loves you and you have to believe in him. If you want to get saved, you have to go to heaven. And Max yelled, "Hey!" Jimmy whirled around and saw him, nearly fell off the stump, and started crying, just like he had when Max first met him, walking along with the beagle. Max couldn't understand it. He'd known Jimmy a while now. It wasn't like he was a stranger. Jimmy probably worried that he was caught in a deception. He told Max and Mr. Knight over and over that he wanted to be a pilot when he grew up, and now he's been caught doing this. But Max wasn't mad at all. If you want to preach, don't worry about it. Do it if it makes you feel good. In the next few months, Max, two or three times more, found him in the woods doing the same weird shit. Jimmy confessed that he now wanted to be a preacher. But what if other people made fun of him or said that he couldn't? Max told him to do what he wants, don't let people stop you, and be your own man. Sound? Later on, when they met again as adults, Jim mentioned this back to him. He said, "I was a scared kid, and he thanked me for encouraging him," said Max. Oof, fuck that. As much or even more than his parents, children in Lynn emphasized conformity. They believed in and followed the same rules, respecting parents and teachers above all. This was typical throughout Indiana, according to a state historian, James H. Madison. He also said that moderation has been the Indiana way, a moderation firmly anchored in respect for tradition. Among the revolutions that have not occurred in Indiana is the generational revolt. Lynn's kids shared toys and treats, girls learned cooking and household skills while boys played sports and roamed the woods, and never shirked chores. Usually they grew up just to be like their parents, which was fine with everybody. And to some small extent, Jim Jones fit in. At least at first. He ran around on the streets like everybody else and loved the Wednesday movies and watermelon. He had a way with animals. Strays seemed to follow him everywhere he went. If he came over to play at your house afterward, your mother probably remarked on what a polite young man he was, polite young boy he was. Jimmy often had great toys. Everybody knew his mother had to work because his father couldn't and that his grandpa and uncles had to help them out financially, but Jimmy still had a lot of stuff. One was a toy movie projector. He bragged that he could put a film in it and show a movie against the wall in his house, just like the Wednesday night film in town. Everyone wanted to see it, but Jimmy's mom had a rule that he couldn't go into the house himself until his parents, or if his parents weren't there, let alone bring in friends. Chuck and Johnny Wilmore were really interested, so after school one day, they snuck into Jimmy's house. His dad was at the pool hall, as usual, and they pulled the blinds down to make it dark and showed movie on the wall. It was fun, till his mother came home, the surprise. She pulled off her belt and chased Jimmy around, swatting at him with it. All the time, he kept screaming, "I didn't mean to do it, I didn't mean to do it," which made no sense because he obviously did mean to do it. Johnny and Chuck ran off and told the other boys what had happened, and all of them felt terribly sorry for Jimmy. It was understood, too, that things weren't entirely right between Jimmy and his dad. In Lynn, sons and dads didn't bond through long talks and hugs. Instead, the boys followed their dads around, watching and learning as the older men did home repairs, worked on cars, and performed the other routine chores that their sons needed to master to get on in life. Old Jim did none of these things because he couldn't. Jimmy didn't seem to respect old Jim too much, and the only time that anybody saw them interacting was when Jimmy ducked into the pool hall and asked his father for spare change. It was pretty fucking sad. But sympathy only went so far. Jimmy might be forgiven for having a mean mother and a sick father, but there were other things about him that set him apart, and not in a good way. He cried a lot, first and foremost. Of past generations will tell you, growing up and crying makes you a pussy. Boys were never supposed to do it. And also, as a little boy, he cussed all the time, so the other boys wondered where he learned the swear words, and Jimmy wouldn't say. He just smiled and enjoyed how his swearing made the rest of the kids uncomfortable. All the other boys were into wrestling around and sometimes getting overzealous and doing punching and kicking with each other. Everyone got a bloody nose or a split lip now and again, except for Jimmy. He was scared of fighting, and he ran away whenever there was roughhousing. I think Jimmy was just a millennial. Then there were the candy bars, rare and prized treats. Jimmy had them all the time, snatching one off store shelves whenever he felt like it. The merchants allowed it because every Saturday, Lynetta Jones came around and paid for whatever candy bars Jimmy took during the week. Any other mother in Lynn would have whacked her son a good one for such behavior, but Lynetta took pride in her boy's audacity. Like her, he found ways to defy convention. But it was the religious things that set Jimmy apart from his peers the most. All the kids in Lynn believed in God and went dutifully to church on Sundays, and it was an accepted part of life. But Jimmy took to it with puzzling extremes, attending all the town churches instead of sticking to one specific. That was the least of it. The strange religious shit started with things that Jimmy said. One day, he and the Wilmore brothers were playing in the loft over the Joneses' garage. There were a series of rafters up near the second-story roof, and the boys thought it would be fun to try and walk out on them. Balancing like tightrope walkers in a circus, the risk was real. It was a straight drop of 10 feet or so to the floor beneath, and Chuck and Johnny Wilmore went first, going single file because the rafters were narrow, with Jimmy right behind him. After a minute or so, he got nervous, thought he might fall. But when he tried to ease back off the rafter, Jimmy wouldn't move. Blocking the way to safety, Johnny yelled, "Move back, Jimmy," with a weird look on his face, blurted, "I can't move. The angel of death is holding me." All three of them teetered precariously on the rafters until Jimmy finally said the angel had let him go. Chuck Wilmore recalls that even at the age of 6 or whatever, I thought that was fucking nuts. This Lynn was famous for its casket. Like, the town's business was death. It made caskets. There was a manufacturer warehouse, and it made its products in Lynn. Jimmy talked a lot about death and its inevitability, and the people in charge of the casket company, like everyone else in Lynn, never locked doors. Jimmy led a contingent of children into the warehouse one night and told everyone to climb into a respective casket and just lie there so that they could find out what it felt like to be dead. That's weird. So you get some sort of idea of what happened to you after that. The other kids were either scared of or, after a while, bored, because Jimmy kept going back, but he had trouble getting anybody else to come with him. Jimmy briefly claimed that special powers were conferred onto him by the Almighty. Challenged to prove it, he rigged a cape, probably a towel, climbed on top of the garage roof, and yelled for everybody to watch him fly. The other kids never believed Jimmy would actually jump, but he did. Instead of flying, he hit the ground fucking hard, and he broke his arm. Afterwards, Jimmy was unabashed. He apparently still believed in his new powers, even if nobody else did. But he didn't mention them in public ever again. Around the same time came the weird animal funerals. Oh, God. There was always a dead critter of any kind, any given kind, around Lynn. Roadkill, squirrels and rabbits, mice, rats, cotton traps, occasionally dogs, cats, always birds. It was the accepted part of the natural environment. Like fallen leaves in autumn, there would be dead animals because that's what happens. Shit dies. They were either left to decay or else scraped up or tossed in the garbage. But now, Jim Jones started reverently picking the dead things up, calling the other kids together, and then performing these macabre, elaborate funeral services, praying over the animal corpses and sermonizing about how God loved all his creatures equally. It was really fucking weird. Yeah, just creepy sermons about how God loved his creations equally and then burying the things in matchboxes or cardboard boxes, depending on their size. At first, I guess it was kind of entertaining, but Jimmy kept on doing it, and pretty soon the others his age refused to participate, but that didn't discourage him. He rounded up younger kids, many of whom were flattered that somebody older would want to hang out with them. When they found out reverent obedience was required rather than playing, they wanted to leave, but Jimmy usually scared them into staying. And even when he couldn't muster a congregation, Jimmy conducted animal funeral services on his own, even at recess in the schoolyard, where the other kids had little choice but to watch, even if they did not participate. And now a word from yet another company that is not sponsoring today's episode.
Everything you ever wanted came in a rocket can!
Power Thirst
Rocket Edition!
With all new flavors like
banana, fizzbitch,
and
gun!
You've had the worst, now try the thirst!
Quencher!
Power Thirst! Side effects include
glowing sweat!
Use your sweaty body to fuel
sweet rave parties! Power Thirst!
Anything is possible!
Air Blasted!
The sport you'll invent because you'll be too energetic for normal sports!
You'll feel like a fighter jet made of biceps!
What about me and my blue collar?
Juice Crazy!
Turn that everyman into a beverage! Beverage stands for beverage!
We interrupt this advertisement to
blow your mind!
Power Thirst now comes in women! Now with purple
preposterous amounts of testosterone.
Preposterone.
Think fast, douche fag. Power Thirst now comes in doves.
Oh, hubcatting.
Similar to bear blasting.
Oh, Lord, why have you forsaken me?
Cannons.
When God gives you lemons, you
find a new god.
Power Thirst.
Godberry. King of the juice. Unacceptable.
Drink Power Thirst and you'll win at everything forever. You'll win at running,
football,
arson,
weddings,
and arse. You'll even win at irony.
Oh, top score.
Still unconvinced? Well, check out these testimonials from real Power Thirst drinkers.
Boop. 400 babies.
Boop. Boop. Power Thirst. It's really...
Boop. All right.
Power Thirst. It's like crystal meth in a can. It's crystal meth in a can. Power Thirst is crystal meth. Warning. May contain anacornacoba.
So when little Jimmy was 10, America's entry into World War II provided him with a weird and very uncomfortable new obsession. Everybody in Lynn was, as was the rest of the country, gripped by war horniness or war fever. It was a patriotic town. So boys in Lynn played soldier during every waking non-school or non-church fucking second. All of them, though, pretended to be soldiers or sailors or Marines, fighting pitched battles against the Axis and winning every time. But how could it be as weird as fucking possible when Jim Jones does it? From the outset, he was fascinated with Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, enamored by their pageantry and mesmerized by the obedient hordes of fighting men goose-stepping in unison. And then there was also the charismatic leader of Hitler. Jimmy studied Hitler intently, how he stood in front of adoring crowds for hours, claiming all sorts of shit, and always keeping audiences engaged with the cunning rhythm of his shouting, and then his hushed tones, then his normal conversation, and he built it back up to a bombastic finish. He was a fantastic speaker. But he had theater training. American newsreels and newspapers were full of Hitler and his worshipful followers, so Jimmy had no shortage of study materials. He, really just the style, not so much the preaching. I don't think he really understood what he was preaching, and I don't think we would for another few years. Hitler was a poor boy who'd emerge to lead a mighty nation thanks to his own determination and his charisma, self-made man, so to speak. Now the whole world knew his name. Millions followed him, and multitudes trembled before him. He gained his power by overcoming powerful foes that looked down on him for his humble upbringings and his controversial beliefs, and it was inspiring. Where the other boys pretended to be American war heroes, Jimmy wanted to emulate Adolf Hitler. It would have been impossible to round up some of the other Lynn boys and persuade them to play Nazi stormtroopers, so Jimmy turned to other recruits. The gaggle of Jones' cousins included several young enough for Jones to bully them into playing whatever roles he wanted. So he herded the little ones into a field and ordered them to goose-step on command. They had trouble figuring out exactly what was required, and Jimmy got mad, so he cut a switch and began swatting at their calves when they didn't march to his satisfaction. Some of them went home with terrible bruises, but when their mothers found out who caused it, Jimmy was in big trouble with his aunts. He lost his squad of make-believe Nazis, but not his fascination with Adolf Hitler. When Hitler committed suicide in April of 1945, thwarting enemies who sought to capture and humiliate him, Jimmy was extremely impressed, and that is some of the creepiest foreshadowing I've ever heard. And even as Jimmy was obsessed with Hitler and the Nazis, his commitment to religion never seemed to waver. During the summer of 1942, Myrtle Kennedy and her husband lived in Richmond, and nobody remembers why, but they moved right back to Lynn in the fall. But while they were out in Richmond and school was out in Lynn, Jimmy lived with them. Lynetta was glad to have him off her hands for a few months. The Kennedys rented part of a big house, and other families lived there too, and there were kids Jimmy's age. 10-year-old Lester Wise in particular, because Jimmy and Lester became summer pals, doing everything together, before going back their separate ways in the fall. But the big thing for both of them was religion. There was a Pentecostal church in Richmond, and they went to a Bible study there 3 or 4 times a week. Rough. And during every Sunday worship service, the preacher always asked sinners to come up and be saved. So the first week, Jimmy went up and got forgiven for his sins. The next Sunday, he did it all again, and then every Sunday for the rest of the summer. According to Lester, you usually didn't do that. You got saved once, and it stayed that way. Maybe you went up again sometimes if you'd done something really bad, but Jimmy went up every time the preacher asked, and he would go up there and kneel, just wait for it. I thought that was weird, but he never talked about why, he just did it. Jimmy returned to Lynn that fall with a new quirk, and all the youngsters living there were country kids, so they knew. They all kind of knew the basics of sex from the time that they were toddlers because of fucking farm animals and dairy cows and shit, how they reproduced. And there was the constant just overrunning of mongrel puppies and kittens provided further elementary evidence of reproduction, at least. And most of Lynn's houses were small and less than soundproof, so in a time when childbirth was frequent, sex was everywhere. It was just that it was never really acknowledged by decent people. As usual, Jim Jones became the exception to the rule, and he offered explicit facts-of-life lectures to younger cousins or friends until they were sick of hearing about it. Other neighborhood kids were invited by Jimmy to join him on his porch and hear all about sexual intercourse. Where he learned all about this fucking bullshit, Jimmy didn't say. His aunts got wind of his new favorite topic and warned him to stop. If they asked Lynetta to intervene, she didn't cooperate. Jimmy kept talking about the forbidden subjects, but then, and later in line in terms of sex, Jimmy was all talk and no action because peers remembered that he never did anything. If he had, word would have spread instantly throughout the community. So he was just one of those fucking annoying kids that everybody remembers, that guy that would make fun of you for fucking not knowing what he was talking about and then just had no idea what he was talking about himself. Because he'd never done it. Maybe he understood the theory, the mechanics of it all, but he'd never actually done it. Although he would lead you to believe that he had. My school had one. I'm certain your school had one. There's one in every school because it's part of growing up. Is figuring out what swear words are really offensive and learning about fucking. To perpetuate the human race. Happens at some point. Not the swearing so much, but the fucking. By the time he started high school, Jim Jones was marginalized among Lynn's teens. But he was not a complete pariah thanks to his talent for compelling conversation. Even those that disliked him found themselves fascinated by whatever he talked about to them. He had that gift of bullshit and rhetoric, and he had the ability to just speak and have people listen. Much like Adolf Hitler. It's pretty funny, actually. But people that disliked him found themselves enraptured by whatever Jimmy decided to talk about to him. Religion and sex were his two main topics, but Jimmy also had retained his knack for eliciting sympathy. For years, Lynn's parents had pitied him and sometimes excused his weirdness because he was obviously coming from a dysfunctional home life. Lynetta was initially the parent blamed most. How could a child grow up normally with a mother who smoked and swore like a sailor and did not go to church? And his mother also loved talking about fucking, too. Like, that was one of her things. But as Jimmy reached his early teens, there was a new rumor. Old Jim was a big-time drinker, just sauced up at all hours. In Lynn, even an isolated incident of drunkenness blighted collective morality. Old Jim had always been the object of pity, what with his awful combat disability and his weird-ass wife. But now his habits seemed suspicious. Every day, the man staggered down the street, headed towards the pool hall. Everyone had seen him stumbling, practically fall, and there were days he could barely balance. Sometimes he disappeared for short stretches. Maybe his drinking binges were the cause. Other than his wife and son, and the Jones family, nobody knew about old Jim's breakdown in 32 or his trips for treatments. When the tales of his drinking started flying, no Jones relative came forward to refute them. So in that time and place, mental illness was considered even more disgraceful than alcoholism, and it was better for him to be thought of as a drunk than as a fucking a guy that suffered from shell shock or a lunatic. In fact, he was neither. Old Jim, with his body failing and his scarred lungs always convulsing, just had a hard time getting out of bed. He was just weak-spirited. But the rumors proved persistent for Jimmy. That's fucked up. For Jimmy, the truth was never a big deal when it came to his own ambitions. He liked being seen as somebody who overcame obstacles, pragmatic, a person who especially deserved sympathy and support, came from the bottom, worked their way up, so on and so forth. Jimmy started dressing differently. High school boys in Lynn wore denim jeans and work shirts, and on Sunday, white shirts and nice slacks. They were appropriate for church attire, but Jimmy wore Sunday clothes every day. He was already striking, with thick, nearly black hair and dark eyes that seemed to stare right through you. Lynetta still sometimes claimed to be part Indian, and now Jimmy picked up that bullshit too. His looks and wardrobe made him stand out. So did the way he acted in school. In hallways between classes, he developed the odd habit of never replying when somebody spoke to him. He participated in between class conversations only when he initiated them. Otherwise, he'd lean against a wall near the classroom door until the bell rang, then hustle inside to take his seat. Always at the back of the room. It's very dramatic. Sometimes he challenged teachers about some facts or the others. And in a typical Indiana country school, that might have been the cause for immediate expulsion. But Lynn's teachers liked evidence that their students were thinking. They'd engage Jimmy in debate, and he seemed to enjoy the give and take, but never admitted being incorrect. His grades were okay, some A's, lots of B's, but he was not an exceptional student. In school, he was never a leader, but on weekends and during summers, he tried to be. He never liked being parts of teams, either. He stayed out of pickup basketball games and bike races. The other boys thought it was because he couldn't stand losing. Besides, Jimmy wasn't a good player and often was the last guy picked, which is embarrassing. That happened to me quite a bit. Sometimes he'd organize his own team and challenge another one to a game. Jimmy never played in these, though. He coached whatever squad he'd put together. Most often, Jimmy's players were younger kids who felt proud that somebody older had paid attention to them. Some Lynn old-timers vividly recall the summer of 45, when 14-year-old Jim Jones not only formed a town baseball team, but organized and ran an entire league with teams from nearby towns. And it would have been a massive undertaking for adults, but Jim did it all by himself. Got the merchants to put up money for bats and balls, then went around finding all the boys who wanted to play and got them to commit to a formal schedule of games. Nobody was used to that. Jimmy managed the Lynn team, and all the boys there in the surrounding towns rooted for Cincinnati Reds. But only the Lynn team got to call themselves the Reds because Jimmy said so. Even though he was too young to have a license, Jimmy drove his team to the games in his family's ancient Model A Ford. It had a rumble seat, and most of the guys could squeeze in. The Lynn kids did pretty well, and Jimmy thrilled them by keeping detailed stats, not just of game scores, but also individual stats. He did these in long, neat columns, and the other kids loved to pore over them. They had never imagined anything so elaborate. It was Jimmy's way of demonstrating that they got something special for letting him be in charge. But things turned sour by the end of the summer because Jimmy's loft was where the team had their meetings. It was their gathering place. So they'd all sit and listen while he lectured about the previous games and what their strategies would be in the next one. There were always animals around, lots of pets. So Jimmy took in all the strays all the time. They seemed to like him. They'd follow him around. And he seemed to love animals. But one day, some of the kids saw him lure a puppy over the open loft trap door and deliberately let it fall down onto the hard floor below. He watched it do the jig of death, having a seizure on the ground, kicking and fucking running in place. And after that, they didn't want to play on his baseball team anymore, and the entire league fell apart. The loft incident was a rare instance of animal cruelty on Jimmy's part. He may have abused the puppy because he was upset by something happening at home. A situation was genuinely traumatic, especially for a teenage boy. Never found out what it was, though. So, on that note, thank you all for tuning back in. This has been another episode of the Anthology of Horror. This is part one of what is certain to be at least a three-parter on Jim Jones and the Cult of the People's Temple. It's something I've been looking forward to covering for quite some time, and I want to do it justice, so I'm not going to rush it. I think you guys will like all the material that I have arranged. It's hard to listen to, but I think it's pretty informative. I learned a lot of stuff doing this episode, and I look forward to learning more to share with you guys. So, without further bullshitting you, this has been another, well, no serious ads. You've got some free comedy today because I got pissed off by another podcast. But there were no serious ads at all during this podcast. And that's how it's been because I value your time, and I just want you guys to take note of that and continue to spread the word on this podcast, rate it if you think I deserve it, and share it, please. And if you could leave some positive comments too, that would be hugely appreciated. So, as is our tradition, let's see the most influential couple of cities from the last few episodes. Let's see the last episode. I have a map, and it illuminates, and has a big dot of illumination in the city that it initiated in, and then smaller illuminations where it spread outwards in the same city, so I can see who is influential. Or, like, who has the most influential. I can't see specifically in the city where you are. So, number one, London. Wait a minute. Yes, this is on the last episode. And then number two, Mountjoy, Pennsylvania. Castle Rock, Colorado. Glasgow, Scotland again. Erie, Pennsylvania. Love this. Belfast, Northern Ireland. Los Angeles, California. Racine, Washington. I'm sorry, Racine, Wisconsin. That's a new one to the list. Thank you very much. Prescott, Arizona. Stockholm. Rancho Cucamonga, California. Colorado Springs, Colorado. Bradford, England. Seattle, Washington. Edinburgh, Scotland. Bolton, England. Tied with Manchester. Tied with Lake Forest. Tied with Gloucester. And tied with Mooresville, North Carolina. Also tied with Wadsworth, Ohio. Thank you all very much for tuning back in. I genuinely appreciate each and every one of you. I can see your support, and I am hugely grateful for it. Thank you. Without you guys, I would not have the fuel to stroke my massive ego with, and I would not be doing this. So thank you for continuing to listen and continuing to reach out. And once again, if you guys think I should change something or cover something else, or you have hate mail, whatever, please do not hesitate to get in touch with me on Instagram. You can reach me by sending a message to DukeLandis17. That is DukeLandis17 on Instagram. I look forward to hearing from you. In the meantime, stay spooky. And here's one more advertisement from somebody that's not sponsoring us.
Ever wish you had sonic hearing? Well, now you can with the amazing Silversonic XL from Bell & Howell. Now you can easily hear sounds that other people can't, and even hear conversations from clear across the room.
John is a...
Hey. Yeah, he is. I hope he's enjoying his surprise party.
The sleek, ergonomically designed Silversonic XL is lightweight and small, just like a cell phone ear adapter. Its flexible ear mount easily adjusts to fit all ear shapes and sizes, and the molded ear tip lets it fit you comfortably. And because it resembles a cell phone ear adapter, no one will ever know that you have sonic hearing. Now you can sit in the balcony and hear the orchestra like you're sitting in the front row. Keep track of your kids while they play in the park. And even hear the doorbell when you're working in the backyard. You'll be amazed at how clear and vibrant every sound is.
Code emergency. We're being attacked by giant dragonflies. Millions of Meganula.
You can watch TV without turning up the volume.
Nobody stores cotton candy like this.
Your Bell & Howell Silversonic XL amplifies sounds up to 50 decibels. There's a high and low switch to vary the sound intensity, and a volume control so you can set just the level you want. With the Silversonic XL, you might even hear things that may pleasantly surprise you.
Her body is
authentic. Through this exclusive TV-only offer, the Bell & Howell Silversonic XL is yours for only $19.95. And just listen to this. When you call, be sure to ask about our deluxe model upgrade that's fully rechargeable and comes with its own charger, so you'll never have to buy another battery again. Get Silversonic XL now and start hearing things you've never heard before.
Finish him.
Call now.